Our featured BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders for this episode are CHC, Creating Healthier Communities, Charity Water, Death with Dignity National Center. To find out more about these and other BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders, go to give.org.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Well, this is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor. Today, my guest is Valerie Green, and she is the artistic director and has been an active dancer and choreographer and teacher in New York City dance community for 21 years. She created her own company, Dance Entropy, in 1998, adding a permanent company home in 2005 called Green Space. Green Space serves the dance community by providing an affordable and welcoming environment for rehearsals, classes, and performances. To date, Valerie has created 28 dances and 8 evening-length works, which we'll talk about. Her choreography has been seen throughout New York City and has also toured to various venues throughout the U.S. Internationally, she's taught and performed in many places around the world, and she has received commissions from Texas State University, BITEF Theater in Belgrade, Serbia, and Theater Alternative in Tirana, Albania. She's also taught at UNLV, Texas State, LaGuardia Community College, University of Nanterre, France. She's also taught at many universities in the United States and other places around the world. Her choreography and teaching style is influenced by her formative years working with the Eric Hawkins Dance Company, and also her certification in body-mind fitness and her undergraduate work at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Valerie, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Art.
Valerie, we've done a number of shows on people who have used the dance arts to give back. And I've always been impressed that our physical motion can mean a lot, not only to our well-being, but also in our ability to communicate and share what we're feeling with others. Have you found that to be the case as well with your work, both in creating dance and performing it?
I would say yes, as it's been my life's work. I started dancing when I was 3 and I never stopped. I've been in New York City for over 28 years now, contributing to this community and field. And I think it's in a way, it's all that I am. And it's a way to share, to receive, to give, to be in community with one another across many different communities and audiences and venues and places. And it's a very, I guess, I want to say, subtle and or unique form in that you don't know how you might connect or touch someone based on their life experiences.
Yeah, it's very true. And I want to also say, you mentioned 3 years old, because every day I get a cache of videos from my daughter and my daughter-in-law featuring my grandchildren. The oldest one is now 5 and a half, and the youngest is 1.5 years. And they're dancing. And it's so amazing. It's almost like innate that we move our bodies when we hear a rhythm or a sound. I'm not sure where that comes from, but when you said 3 years old, it made me think about my own grandchildren and what I see in them. I guess that was the case for you, but is this normal? I guess it is normal.
Well, actually, I think it's an interesting point you're bringing up because children are very not so inhibited at that age, and they hear music and the body wants to move, and that's a natural reaction to music and rhythm. And I want to say like the joy in one's birthright. But as we get older, a lot of things happen to us that sort of takes away some of that openness, and, you know, a lot of things get layered in and things happen to us. So it sort of can change the person to not be able to express themselves in this open and free way. Yeah, I think everybody has it in the beginning of their life, this freedom. And then depending on our life experiences, parts of it gets, I want to say, clouded, not exactly taken away, but like a layer goes over us where we can't shine in the same way.
Interesting. And what can we do to keep that? Because I think it's so important to feel that freedom.
Well, I mean, for me, the dance, I'm 51 and I know no world without movement and dance. I've never stopped dancing. And even though I'm not performing now, I'm choreographing on my dancers. And, you know, it is all of me, but it's through them, but it's still me with them on the stage, even if I'm not, you know, dancing or through all my teaching work. But, you know, movement is essential to our being and our health. And when we're not in our bodies, a part of us is also not even present in the world or in relation to others or ourself.
When you say all of me, you've said that now twice, so I have to ask you to get into that a little bit. What do you mean, all of you?
Interesting question. In making a work, it's such a deep process that has so many different layers of investigation, exploration, questioning. And I think that the process that I have to do just when I'm with myself and thinking about the work and directing the work and creating it, you know, it's not just about them. It's really sitting with myself and thinking about what I'm communicating and sharing, what I want to give to an audience, what I want to give for my dancers to express. So I guess when I say all of me, I think of it as, you know, exploring all parts of my being and then offering them to others.
Well, the offering you to others is really sort of about what this podcast is about. You know, we're really interested in understanding what motivates people to want to give themselves to others in many of the ways that you're describing. And is there something aside from just the dance itself that is inside you that says, I need to contribute in some way? Or is it simply an extension of dance that makes you want to do it? Or is there some combination?
Well, I think it's a combination. Like, first, I love to dance and create and express. But for example, in creating my studio, Green Space, which is a company home, it was always from the beginning a shared intention to not just have a home for the company, but have a place for the community to have a place to connect, to create work, and to share their work. So it was from day one in creating my venue to have it be a space for the New York City dance community. And the different programs there are opportunities to give people chances to do their work, to create their work, to take risks, to try new things. And it's a giving to the dance community to have access. So that's one bit of it. But I'll pause for a second before I go into my other work with the community, if you want to remark on that.
Valerie, you created this space for a community of dancers in New York quite a while ago. What were you seeing back then that gave you a sense of the need to do it? And what made you follow through with that and try to create this space to begin with?
Well, at that time, I was managing a studio in downtown Manhattan, and that's where all the sort of modern dance contemporary studios were, and they were slowly being lost to luxury real estate, you know, one by one by one. And I noticed at that time that something was starting to happen in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is the first neighborhood outside of Manhattan. And so I thought, well, that's going to happen in Queens. And there's not really anything in Queens. So I'm going to build it in Queens and see if they will come. And so that's what I did. It was a very, very strategic move because there was only one place that was a rehearsal studio, but nothing in all of Queens. And Queens is a huge borough. And I just knew that based on what was happening in Brooklyn, that that would also happen in Queens. So I was looking all over Long Island City, which is the first neighborhood in Queens outside of Manhattan, for the right kind of space, like a sort of loft factory space. And I found the perfect one. It was a former silk factory. So it had, you know, really large, beautiful floors, windows, and it was the right kind of vibe for similar to like what used to be in Soho at that time, the factory dance spaces, lofts. Yes, people did follow me. They came and it became a hub for people making work of all different sort of dance aesthetics and genres. And then very quickly, I started our first program, which is called Fertile Ground. They're all off of the sort of theme of green, because green space, well, my name is green, but I saw it as a place for dance to grow. So Fertile Ground is a works in progress series where it is not curated. So choreographers of all kinds can, you know, try something, take a chance. I don't want to say fail because that's not the right word, but explore, try new things. And then we get into a circle. I get the audience and all the performers in a circle, and I moderate a discussion over wine. And the audience contributes to what they see in the work, what they feel, how they respond. And it's a way for the choreographers to learn about how their work is being received and for them to get feedback in a non-colored way. So actually, the choreographer doesn't talk about their dance. They're just receiving the feedback. And the reason why is if a choreographer explains their dance, then everything the audience says is going to be colored by what the choreographer just told them. Mm-hmm. So I am a very, like, very specific format of moderating that. And the choreographers get really in-depth feedback. You know, the audience is excited to be able to talk about the dance and sort of be involved in its creation in some way. So that's a very much community situation of with audience and performers. Because a lot of times in New York, it'll be performers on one side, audience on the other. But this is about everybody being in the circle and being a part of the discussion. So that's been running for 17 years. And then there's a program called Take Root, which is for a little more established choreographers, and they do a split bill. And both of these programs, a lot of our choreographers, you know, first opportunities in New York. Fertile Ground, anybody can do, but Take Root is a produced, presented opportunity. So a lot of times it's hard to be presented in New York City. It's a very tough city. It's very exclusive in many ways in the dance community. And it's important for me to have a venue and a curatorial mission that everybody can have a place to fit and belong. And that there's a lot of different genres and aesthetics of dance, but they all have a value to be seen. And what might not be one's cup of tea is somebody else's. And so I think that it's important for people can be that they can be seen in what they're creating and what they're doing. And I like to say have a place to fit, but I guess have a place to belong and be seen is important in amongst a city that's so challenging to kind of grow your dances in. So those are some of the community-focused, inspired dance programs in the studio. And I do a lot more with my education, but as far as presenting choreographers, those are like the main programs for them.
Now, you have sort of an educational background as well. How much does that drive what you're doing here with the choreographers? And how are you also educating people in dance and also in performance?
Well, I think in educating people in dance is them being involved in that like feedback circle. So they're learning about how to talk about dance, how to look at dance, how to engage in a conversation with it. But besides that, we work with a lot of different people outside of who's in the studio. So myself and teaching artists go into public schools, teach dance, kids. You never know when you're going to impact someone. So if you're going into a classroom in New York City and teaching any kind of dance style, like you don't know what moment you're going to make a difference in someone's lives. So I think that it starts at an early age to have access to the arts, to see it, to have people want to teach you it, to have more personal connection is part of growing, you know, future dancers, future audience members. And we also work in older adult centers, and our residencies there are not just going in and teaching dance, but we make a dance with the older adults. We bring them to my studio so they see one of my new works in progress, and then we talk about it and have a conversation there. We also do a performance then at the end of the residency in the center. So we feature the older adults and their dance, then my company performs with them. I think these ways of being in community are just important for many reasons, like connection, education on dance, growing audiences. I don't see it as just giving, but there's a lot of receiving at the same time. Because if I am teaching in a senior center somewhere and I see someone laughing and smiling and, you know, they're older than me, their wisdom, their life experiences, like there's still like this beautiful reciprocity and just this engagement together. And I find it very special. So we all impact one another. Even if I'm giving the offering, someone impacts me and how they receive it as well. And it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
I want to go back to the establishment of your studio and ask you, you know, what you did isn't easy to do. And there had to be moments where you were not getting what you wanted and had to kind of fight through that. What kept you going? And what were some of those moments, if you can remember back, where you might have felt, I don't know if I can do this?
Well, what I can say in my strategic move to Long Island City over 18 years ago is seeing how much the landscape of Long Island City has changed. And, you know, there's luxury high rises all over the place now. It's a totally different neighborhood. And so the obstacles along the way were the rent increases, big jumps in my rent to come up to market value of the changing landscape. Even made a whole dance in relation to that called Impermanent Landscape. So the biggest challenges were the increases with the rent, and also seeing, you know, as an organization, Dance Entropy, can it be strong enough if there is no studio attached to it? You know, can my work and my educational programming, because the not-for-profit is sort of breaking into three arms, the studio as a rehearsal space and all its programming, the company which performs all over, and the third part, the education. So if I didn't have the studio, would the organization be strong enough without it? So strategically, I've been trying to make sure that the organization, you know, basically is strong enough without it, that if at one point I choose to not have the studio because it is a lot of work, that the organization can survive. So that's sort of been the challenge, to keep like strategic planning ongoing for the changing landscape of never know what's going to happen. And I think because it's my life work, somehow I never like gave up or wanted to give up. And I think what's kept me engaged and interested is that I keep shifting what I do inside my organization with my interests as well. Like in the last many years, I've been going deeper into my movement healing work and movement and trauma. And, you know, that's growing inside my organization. So I think as long as I keep growing the organization along with my sort of curiosities, it can stay fresh in some ways, but it's still a lot of work.
I'm certain it is. You mentioned that the challenge is sometimes in getting the pricing right for a facility and trying to figure out if you even need a facility to carry out your mission. I'm sure you prefer to do it that way. But I think it's very interesting that you have even considered operating, if necessary, without a facility. And I say that because there are a number of organizations that I know of right now that are in very precarious financial situations. And they're making decisions around, do we close or do we get our situation to a place where we just keep the lights open or keep the doors open, keep the C3 in place and build from the ground if we have to, give ourselves time to develop new sources of revenue, new program models, and come back and approach this mission in a fresh, more startup way. And every organization I talk to that is in that position say, no, we're not going to close. If we have to, we will go down to bare bones, but we're not going to close. And we're going to fight our way through it, recognizing what many people don't understand about nonprofits, which is most of them have to raise all the money that they plan to spend in the same year. So you start at zero. Most organizations start at zero every year. If they want to run a program, they have to raise all the money that they want to raise for that year and in that year, or else there is no program. And most people don't quite understand that. But it's one of the more courageous, I think, decisions that people make to work in nonprofits or to start nonprofits, because you never know if you're going to get the funding that you need to operate. You never know what your costs are going to be, so that maybe what you're doing this year might not work next year because the cost structures have changed, as you've seen. But people persevere. Now, maybe in your case, you're persevering because, as you say, it's just my life. You can't even see yourself doing anything else. But there are lots of people who can see themselves doing other things, but yet they persevere with these missions. It's just remarkable to me. What do you say about that?
Well, a lot of what you're saying is resonating for me. And, you know, I have, honestly, some questions myself. Like, I've been doing this a long time. Like, part of me is ready for some sort of shift and change, but it's hard to understand. I can't imagine to not have the studio, but I'm thinking about succession planning. I'm trying to strategically plan, as I'm sure you know, many founders of not-for-profits, you know, how they make plans to step back because of facing burnout. So these are all things that are very alive for me right now, and figuring out how to manage these large questions. You know, like, I've spent so many years building this. It's not something you want to just drop or walk away from. It's to figure out how you can be, I want to say, maybe honor myself and honor what I built and honor the communities that I serve. And it's not an easy thing to figure out. There's a lot of moving parts. So I don't know that I have the answer to it.
And now it's time for our giving tips segment with Bennett Weiner, one of the world's most renowned experts on charity accountability and the COO of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
Today, I'd like to talk about charity impact. This is an issue that's gotten a lot of attention in recent years. BBB Wise Giving Alliance, interestingly, began to address this issue back in 2003, before any other charity monitoring organization had addressed it at that time. And our focus has been in encouraging charity boards to receive, at least once every 2 years, some type of written summary of how well they're addressing their mission. It could be, for example, identifying what goals they've had and how well they've achieved those goals in some type of a narrative form that's shared with the board. The reason that we focused on the board getting this information is that we wanted the information about charity impact to be as open and clear as possible so the board can make its own decisions on whether they need to have a change in direction. Public reporting is fine, and certainly we encourage charities to make such information public if they so desire. But our concern was that once it becomes a public report, there is a tendency to make it sound always better. In other words, the charity is always receiving more impact and begins to have a type of annual report quality. And that's understandable as to why that could happen. The other thing is that there's a significant difference between outputs and outcomes. And what I mean by outputs is how many meals served, how many people served, how many things the charity does on whatever they're promising to do. That's one way of measuring what their activity is. However, that's not necessarily the same thing as outcomes. Has their activity, for example, helped address poverty in a certain area? Has it helped address a certain disease in a certain way? And those are broader goals, And it's very difficult to identify which any one organization has had more influence on an issue than others. So outcomes sometimes are a bit of a challenge to really determine for a specific group. If you want to learn more about this subject and also learn about how our other standards address accountability, please visit give.org and click on the BBB Charity Standards.
No, it's just really a remarkable trait that I find in people who lead these organizations, that they're willing to start from scratch if necessary every year and see what they can do to move this mission forward. I was talking to a futurist friend of mine who's written many books on how institutions and individuals can prepare for the future. And he used to speak a lot about a VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. He says, but VUCA doesn't quite really capture the actual world that we're living in today. And he says what more directly captures this world is concepts such as brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible. He feels that those are the words that more directly capture, and this, the gentleman's name is Bob Johansson, and we just had this talk the other day, and I quickly scribbled down these concepts on a sheet of paper every time I get a chance to talk to Bob. He gives me something to think about. But he says that you deal with these thoughts with words such as bendable. Then he says attentive, neuroplasticity, and inclusive. So we address brittle with bendable. We address anxious with attentiveness. We address a nonlinear situation with neuroplasticity. And things that are incomprehensible, we deal with by being inclusive and thinking in a full spectrum kind of way. And I don't know if any of those concepts seem to resonate with you, but when I think of small nonprofits that are trying to achieve a mission, they very much have to be inclusive to deal with things that they don't understand, right? You have to reach out to people who you don't know and try to find new approaches and answers to questions. And yeah, problems aren't linear always, right? Especially in the world that we live in. You know, we wish we could say, all right, if I solve this problem, then I know I can solve that problem, but it doesn't always work like that. It seems like there's a constant flow of issues that we have to deal with that makes it very difficult for us. But if our brains can be more malleable and flexible in understanding how things fit together, we might have a better chance of that. And obviously, attentiveness, just being willing to attend to the issues. Now, in your case, you mentioned a really important phrase, burnout. And we should talk about that some in just a second. But being attentive is important. And bendable, right? We might be able to operate without a facility if we have to. You know, maybe there are some greater things that can come for our mission if we free ourselves from the concern about a facility. Maybe we can do more. But I want to ask you about this question of burnout, because that's key. Lots of nonprofit leaders feel that. How are you managing that? How are you dealing with this whole question of burnout? Because you've been doing this for a long time. Then this month, I celebrate 23 years heading the BBB Wise Giving Alliance. And I'll tell you, I'm not interviewing myself, so I'm not going to give you the answer how I deal with it. But I want to hear how you deal with it.
Well, all those words that you were sharing were beautiful and resonate, but adaptable, malleable, resilient, perseverance, they all come into play with running a not-for-profit and into play with managing it. Even if one has people working for you, there is still this strategic oversight and management of the team. And there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of balls in the air and making sure that they all, you know, are in the air and that none of them drop. So I'm very good at that. I'm very good at operating on many levels at the same time and wearing many hats. So that's a blessing and a curse also, I realize. And because I'm working in what I love so much, it's easy to get lost in doing what I love and just get overly sucked in and immersed into it. And, you know, excited about things, excited about my teaching and my making work. I'm not always the best. I work with other people to care for them, but I could be better at caring for myself at times because I get so excited to do many things and see things and do things. I think the body care is like having time with, I mean, for me being a mover, but this really should be for anybody, is to have time with their body to work through any tension or stress and find release and do a lot of somatic sort of exercises with myself. And I do make time to do that. So I think that's sort of my part of a big part of my self-care. But at the same time, I also feel a lot of sense of overwhelm in the bigger picture and continually try to figure out how to manage that. I guess, you know, I want to keep learning always. And I would like if somebody could step in and be a part of running my organization, that I can go deeper into the parts that are changing with my age and my shifting interests, and that the space is and can continue to be a resource to the community. But I could also honor like my growing self and needs and change at the same time. So that's sort of the challenge at the moment. That makes sense.
Valerie, these conversations are always very revealing. And I had no idea that an interview with a woman who created a dance facility and a dance program would actually lead to a conversation about succession planning and burnout. But here we are. I'm curious to know how you view succession planning. You mentioned now that you'd be interested in finding someone who could take on some of the responsibilities. But whose responsibility is it in your organization to make sure that there is a clear path towards succession and that new leadership is identified at the right time?
That's my responsibility. It's going to be on me to think about how, yeah, I have a board, but you know, every board is a little bit different. And the conversations are, I guess, more so spearheaded from myself. And, you know, there's a lot of dance companies actually that face this question as well. Does a company continue and expand in some other way past their founder, or does it stop? Some have stopped and other people wanted the work to continue, and then it was a big mess. Some plan for it. There's been really, it's actually an interesting question. There's been so many different variables, and some are just small. And then, you know, someone changes and they stop. But for me with Dance Entropy, you know, there is a lot of parts to it. It's not just my work. It's the education, the studio. So it's for me a bigger question because I'm so rooted in community and think community is important in so many ways that I'm at a point in my life where I'm thinking about these questions. Not before, you know, I'm trying to figure out. I mean, obviously, I'd still be making my own work, but I think for the longevity over the organization and its health, it's an interesting question to think how, where do we move from here? How do we keep going? And again, how do we adapt? There's that word again, with change of what one's needs are. So, you know, I'm taking steps to work on it and the board is supportive, but ultimately it's me that needs to self-activate on all those needs.
But, you know, New York is so rich in many ways with dance opportunities, yet we have to think about the number of people in the city who have interest in this and who may still not find a home to dance and to learn about dance.
Well, dance in New York City is interesting because there's different genres and aesthetics of dance. So there's sort of its own ecosystem. There's big dance sort of clearinghouses that have a lot of classes all day. There's some smaller organizations like me that are a space that might have some, but I mean, I'm still actually a little bit unique with my not-for-profit in that there's a company, we do all this education, and then there's rehearsal space and presenting programs. So like in Queens, there's nobody that's quite like me and doing all those different things. So there is people that are renting rehearsal space all over New York City from different kinds of dance organizations. And some are just small studios that are just rental spaces. Some might have classes, some might have shows. So there's like an interesting ecosystem of dance venues in New York City, but somehow there's an ebb and flow to it all. Something new emerges, something goes away. But what I can say is that the dance community of New York City is very resilient and will keep persevering, because dance is the art form that gets a chop off of funding like continuously. And I feel like dancers and choreographers are always trying to reinvent themselves to survive in this city. And it's sort of the survival and the fittest in a lot of ways. This is not for everybody here. It is a hustle, big time. And if someone is not a hustler, then it's not a place for them. You have to hustle to survive in the city. And New York will chew you up and spit you out. So the new crops come and people leave. So it's, again, a survival of the fittest and how you can adapt and be resilient and persevere if you're going to stay inside this dance ecosystem. So, you know, there is a little bit of finding where you fit. And for me, I think it's finding your community where you feel like you're accepted and belong. And if you can find where you feel seen and can belong, there's room to grow inside that. And that, I think, was part of my success, is finding like community for me where I felt comfortable and that I could like grow up inside of.
No, it's a great answer. It's a great answer. And I just want to, it leads me to ask, how much collaboration is actually going on? Because when I think about how nonprofits can succeed in their missions, more are collaborating in my experience, but it's still not easy. And I think sometimes we look at our organizations and we say, okay, we have a pretty good situation here. We kind of know what we're doing. We want to make sure it stays successful, and we're just going to have to compete. And that's natural. It's understandable. Yet at the same time, if there are others who we can work with to help us serve our mission, do we have somewhat of a obligation to consider that? And it's a two-way street, obviously. You can't have one side wanting to collaborate and the other doesn't want to. And collaborations don't also have to be equal in terms of the size of the entities. There can be asymmetrical collaborations, right? It's big organizations with small organizations, organizations that serve a community with organizations that serve broader communities. Organizations that are doing one genre, maybe collaborating to do something new in a different genre. I'm just curious, are you seeing that kind of effort among dance companies in New York City or more broadly in the United States from your perspective?
I think of collaborative in so many different ways, because as an artist, I collaborate with visual artists and composers and my dancers in one respect. So there's collaboration in that, which allows our work to get out to bigger audiences and have more depth. There's collaboration in working with other organizations that I feel like I'm doing all the time in my educational work, and I see it as a win-win. Some people are just, I want to say, like, not noticing opportunities. Like, for example, we have funding for a program where we work with partners and are going to give them this offering. But if they don't respond to the email, then we can't collaborate. It's like, here's something free for you. This is a little bit of a pet peeve, that there is people complaining about access and resources, but then there's actually quite a lot out there, and sometimes people don't want to take it. So I think like that's a whole separate conversation, but I encounter a lot of that there's a lot of places open for collaboration that people are just not, I guess, paying attention to in some ways. And I think collaboration is a way for, I think it can be a win-win in that, like, I'm offering something you need. I think there's a lot that can happen in collaboration. If it's two dance companies housed under the same roof, that's a different kind of collaboration. That's a little bit more, I think, can be more challenging. So I think it depends on the collaboration, but I think it's a concept is throughout all parts of the industry, and in any industry, is how do we collaborate to do what we do better or to offer more to people that need it?
Well, Valerie, you're a hustler. I love that phrase because I think things that you want to do that are hard, you have to hustle. You have to get out there and take a chance and not be so concerned about the concept of failure and not even recognize what that is. And clearly that's you.
Yeah, it's funny because I keep going. I want to do something. I figure it out. I'm very curious about things. And honestly, I'll keep trying until you tell me no.
So. Well, sometimes you keep going when they tell you no, right? I mean, you think about many of the great institutions that have been created in the world. Somebody heard no somewhere along the way, or it's crazy, especially with a nonprofit, because you don't have any money. You don't necessarily have a whole lot of people who are with you. You just have this idea and this energy and maybe this talent and this will to actually make something where something does not exist. And by the way, in many cases, it's something that the marketplace has already said, you can't make any money doing that. So there's no business case for it. But people do it anyway. It's the most amazing thing about nonprofits.
Yeah.
And people do it.
Yeah. I just want to say, you said will, talent, and what was the one?
Energy. You got to have energy.
Energy. That's it.
And they make it happen. So kudos to you. We're coming to the end of this, but I wanted to give you a chance to tell our listeners how they can be supportive and connect with you and in the work that you're doing.
Sure. So you can find us naturally on all the social media channels at Dance Entropy and at Green Space Studio. Also, those are our websites. So danceentropy.org, greenspacestudio.org. You can call us, email us, our websites tell you everything that we're doing. One is more about the studio and all the programs, and one is more about the company and all our education, but it's all Dance Entropy. We love meeting new people. Come see a show. If you want to take a class, if you want to collaborate, you can find me. If you want to give a donation, you can find me. And I hope we reach some new people, and I'm happy to have been here, Art, as a part of this conversation.
Well, I love the idea of entropy, although what you're doing doesn't feel totally like randomness to me.
Well, it's organizing the chaos.
Okay. All right. There you go. Organizing chaos. There you go. Making sense where there may not necessarily be any sense. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. I think of Dance Entropy as an organizing the chaos. There's all these possibilities and I bring it together into something hopefully beautiful.
Well, I've seen some of your work on YouTube and it is indeed beautiful. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
Now, to all of you who are listening, this is a weekly show, the Heart of Giving podcast, and you can find a new episode every Tuesday. I hope you'll subscribe to the show because that's how we grow our audience. We don't have a big marketing budget. In fact, we don't have any marketing budget. We just put it out there. And you'll know that the shows that we put out are with amazing people who are doing incredible things in their communities and around the world. And you're going to be inspired by their stories. You're going to be inspired to want to get up and do something, be supportive. If you can't get up and do anything, you're going to do something financially, maybe. You're going to want to volunteer. Maybe you're even going to want to participate in some of the things that these organizations are doing. So if you're not prepared for what may happen to you, maybe this isn't the podcast for you. But if you are, if you think that there's a world out there that you can contribute to making better and you're not quite sure how to get off that fence, then this is the podcast for you. So listen to some episodes, share it with your friends. And I want to thank our guest today, Valerie Green, who's doing amazing work. Valerie, again, congratulations. And I hope we'll see you around. Take care, everybody. We'll see you back here next week.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.